Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we have a great show for you today focused around junior tennis development. And I think you're going to find today's guest very interesting and also very thought-provoking. So I hope you will enjoy it. If you have questions today, as always, you know you can call in. We'd love to hear from you. That number is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853 if you have questions. Also, just a reminder to you guys that this is the last week to get your nominations in for our inaugural Parenting Aces Best Tournament Director Award. And you can find that nomination form on our website at parentingaces.com. I hope if you've had a phenomenal experience with a specific tournament director that you'll take the time to send in a nomination and have that tournament director recognized for the great work he or she is doing on behalf of our kids. I think it's time we recognize these folks who give up lots and lots of time for not a whole lot on the back end in terms of monetary reward. And, they provide the fabric for our kids to get out there and compete week in and week out. And so I'd like to just give a shout out to the ones who are doing it well. So the deadline to get that nomination in is Monday, December 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern. So please take a look, get your nomination done, and if you have any questions or have trouble finding the form, you can always email me at lisa@parentingaces.com, and I'll be glad to send you the direct link. All right, before I tell you about today's guest, I'm going to go to a quick commercial, and when I come back, a little intro for our guest today, and then we'll jump right into the show. Enjoy.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.
Welcome back to Parenting Aces. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and today we have as our guest Shane Sable. And Shane and I have interacted quite a bit on Facebook. That's how we connected to one another. And Shane is currently coaching juniors. He is at the Tri-State Athletic Club in Evansville, Indiana. But before that, he was a nationally ranked junior coming up. He played in college at the University of Wisconsin and played on the satellite tour for a bit. He then jumped into coaching and worked for Nick Saviano, who you may remember as a guest on the show last year. Nick has also been working with Jeannie Bouchard, although he just announced that they have terminated that coaching relationship, which I'm a little disappointed to hear. For both of them, I think that was a win-win for them, but I wish them the best of luck moving forward. But anyway, Shane coached for Nick for 2 years. He was the head pro at Terramar Park in Parkland, Florida for 5 years, coached at Turnberry Isle, Aventura, Florida for 3 years, and as I said, he's currently in Indiana. He also has another hat that he wears in that he was the co-founder of Soulfire Tennis Clothing. And so for those of you who watch the professional matches, either in person or on TV, You've probably seen some of the pros wearing Soulfire in recent months, and so that's kind of a cool side venture that Shane has. So without any further ado, I'm going to bring Shane on the line. Shane, are you with us?
I'm here.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your experience and your coaching philosophy with the rest of us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Sure. I'm having trouble hearing you. I don't know if maybe you can turn the volume up on your end just a bit.
Can you hear me?
I mean, I'm hearing you. It's just a little faint. That's better. Thank you.
That's better?
That's better, yeah. Okay, so I touched on a few of the highlights of your tennis career, and if I missed anything, I apologize, but what really spurred me to invite you to come on the show today was a conversation that was happening on Facebook around a tennis tip that you had posted, and I'm going to just read that briefly because I just want to give my listeners kind of an overview of how we got started. So your tip of the day was, parents be parents and let coaches do the coaching. Tennis coaches don't go into the lawyer's office and tell them how to practice law. The same rule needs to apply in junior tennis. And as expected, that tennis tip posted a couple weeks ago spurred a lot of conversation and a lot of Facebook likes. And so it was kind of interesting, and I jumped into the conversation a bit. And one of the challenges, I think, for both coaches and for parents is knowing what our role is and where the overlap occurs and then where the overlap needs to cease. So I'd like to start today by asking you to share your philosophy of the parent's role in their child's tennis development.
To me, the parent's role in the tennis development of a junior player would be to support their kids both financially and emotionally, and to help with the process and to actually be the deciding factor of who would be coaching the kids, who would be doing the fitness training for the kids, you know, interacting with those coaches and trainers as to which tournaments and you know, and probably meeting with the parents once every month or two and having a broad game plan. And outside of that, unless the parent is a second or third generation, you know, college athlete or tennis player, I just don't think that, I think it takes up a lot of time, and it's counterproductive a lot of time to always be going back and forth on strategy with teaching professionals that have spent their entire lives coaching tennis.
Well, that's a valid point. And, you know, playing devil's advocate a bit, there are a lot of teaching professionals out there that call themselves teaching professionals but really aren't. And so I'm hoping maybe you can shed some... I'm sorry?
No, I totally agree with you, but I have to say that just like there's TripAdvisor, just like there's Zagat's, just like there's the 100 lawyers, there's different ways and there's different certifications and there's different word of mouth to find out, you know, which pros have produced junior players that are nationally, internationally ranked, that have gone on to play college or pro. You can check out a coach's track record. Most coaches will provide you their track record. So I think that going back to what is the parent's role, one of the parent's biggest role in the whole development process would be scouring the potential candidates out there and finding a great teaching professional for their kids, especially between the ages of 4 and 9. I think that is one of the parents' biggest roles in the whole development process.
And so for a family that lives in an area that isn't a tennis-rich environment, what if there's only one or two people out there, and if neither of them have the track record or have the resume that, you know, would give a parent confidence in their ability to develop a child? What's a parent to do in that situation?
I grew up in Evansville, Indiana, and right now it's a town of about 300,000 in the surrounding areas. When I was very young, I didn't have the opportunity to be coached by him, but Doug Cash ran our junior program at Tri-State Racquet Club, and then he went on to become the president and CEO of Tennis Clubs of America, and now he owns a company that consults tennis clubs. And when he ran the program at Tri-State, there were a lot of surrounding areas that didn't have quality pros or pros in general. Owensboro, Kentucky, Jasper, Indiana, Henderson, Kentucky, Bloomington, all places that were within an hour, hour and a half away. And those kids traveled in to be part of the program. And Doug Cash went on to, you know, coach Lanier Rancho, number one in the country, and to take 25, 30 kids to the Orange Bowl every year, and to coach Nero Patel and Bimal Patel. And just, I mean, he had about 20 nationally ranked kids in a 60-person program year in and year out. And tennis is one of those things, tennis and golf are those kind of sports and team that, you know, obviously they cost more money to play, and you're going to have to travel for tournaments, and you're also probably going to have to travel for good coaching once in a while if you really want to go to the next level and play Division I tennis and have a chance to go further.
So are you suggesting that a parent of a four-year-old travel an hour for a tennis lesson?
100%.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, isn't that unrealistic?
An hour of travel?
For a tennis lesson?
I mean, to me, it depends on, like, what the parent's goals are in tennis. I hear a lot of times that, you know, this kid doesn't want to be cut, or this kid just likes to do it recreationally, or this kid just wants to play for fun. Well, that's great and all, but I think every kid should have the chance to have the right strokes and to develop the kind of game that they can play for the rest of their lives, and nobody should limit where they can go with their game. And I think between the ages of 4 and 7, if you don't have the right foundation, it's going to be very tough for you to take your game to the highest point you can get to. And to be honest with you, with the amount of people coaching tennis and coaching sports and physical training people and having certifications in the States now, I don't think you can find that many metropolitan areas in the U.S. that within 30 to 45 minutes you can't find a decent professional.
Right, and I understand that for, you know, an older kid, but I'm questioning, you know, for these younger children who aren't even in school yet, you know, does that make sense for a family?
I think, to be honest with you, the biggest pitfall that the U.S. has had in development over the last 30 years is that we, our best teaching professionals, like to cherry pick and coach a lot of the top kids once they're 13, 14, and 15, whereas in France, all the top coaches work with 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, and then they work with them again at 16 and 17, 18. I think that if you want your kid to have a career and to play Division I or get a college scholarship, then you're going to have to find, or if you don't want to travel at 4, wait 2 years to start at 6, because not a lot happens between 4 and 6. I mean, you're re-teaching a lot of the same things, so if you want to wait till 6 and you're in an area that doesn't have a quality pro, wait till 6 to travel to half an hour for those lessons.
Okay. All right. And so one thing you just mentioned in describing what the goals are is having fun and playing recreationally. Before we went on the air, you and I were talking about that whole concept of fun. And I've written a lot about that, you know, on Parenting Aces and have caught a little bit of flack, but mostly people are in agreement, I think. Talk about what your definition of fun is and the role of fun in developing a player.
I think the definition of fun and the role of fun in developing a player comes down to this. I think that passion and fun probably go hand in hand. And when you find something that you're passionate about and have a goal and you see yourself getting closer and closer to that goal over time, I think that the fun part probably comes into play more. I think that being around coaches and other players that are positive, that, you know, that have a good sense of humor, you know, helps out. But I think that you can definitely turn a lot of the speed drills and agility drills as 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds into games where they are racing, whether it's duck, duck, goose, whether they're playing frisbee football, whether they're trying to see who can catch the most tennis balls out in the field first. I think you can trick the kids a lot and by having a lot of fun, but after half an hour, 45 minutes, they've worked out harder than just doing normal sprints. So I think that there's a lot of ways to have a lot of fun and to really work hard at the same time. And at the same time, I wouldn't say that fun's the number one goal for the top pros that teach, but if you could find a way to incorporate both, that's great. But I think the real fun in most sports or most endeavors is going to come from success in competing, and a lot of that will come in the mastery in the tournament level.
So, I mean, there's a lot of talk about, you know, hit and giggle tennis and how that's interfering with tennis development. But what you're saying is there's a way to incorporate those types of games, but also make them productive.
100%.
And one of the things we were saying before we went on the air is, you know, it doesn't have to be fun every day or every minute of the training, and that it's okay for some days to be rough and for the kid to come home every now and then and say, you know, this was not fun today. It was really hard. I was very frustrated, and it was not fun.
Yeah, I have to... Lisa, there?
Sorry, had a little technical difficulty there. Go ahead.
Lisa.
Yes, sorry.
I've had two great mentors in my life. One on the business side, and that was J. Darius Bykoff, who started the company Vitamin Water and Glasso and sold it to Coca-Cola for $4 billion. And he loves tennis, plays it a ton, wrote me a recommendation of business school. And what he always told me is, you know, I was getting ready to go to my graduate business school, and he said, Shane, it's all about the journey. You got to enjoy the journey. So I always keep that in mind. And the second thing is, you know, I've been very fortunate over the past 5 or 6 years to work for a guy named Kenneth Collins, who coached Davis Cup and Ivory Coast for 5 years, worked for Arthur Ashe, coached Grambling, coached Tyler, coach on the tour, and ran my program, United States Tennis Federation, in Terramar Park in Florida, and sent 25 kids to college scholarships and had 70 kids ranked in the top 10 in Florida from the ages, you know, he started them at 4 years old up to 18, and it was a very inexpensive program. Most of the kids spent 10 or 12 grand a year between the ages of 14 and 18 and got $150,000 to $250,000 scholarships. So when he always says that, you know, you really got to, you know, the parent has to either be the nice guy and the coach has to be the mean guy, or the coach has to be the mean guy and the parents be the nice guy. You can't have both sides pounding at the kid. So if the parent's really hard on the kid at home and really tough, then the coach has to kind of play the nicer role, and vice versa, because if the kid has both sides, you know, grilling them, they're going to shut down. Or if the kid has, you know, both sides being so nice, they're going to be too soft. So I'm not saying that the coach always has to be the strictest of the two. I'm saying you have to know your players, know your parents, know the whole process, and feel out. I don't think there's a cookie-cutter approach to it.
Right, which requires a lot of communication between the parent and the coach then.
Not 100%. I think you can read enough and get enough from the parents when they're around and from the kids and what they say about the parents and what have you. I think that it is good to have scheduled time to talk with the parents every once in a while, but I don't think that they should feel like our time is not important and they can call us any hour of the night or they can, you know, complain all the time. I think that once, it's almost like a contract. Once you decide on a pro and you've checked out their resume and what they do, and once you see a progress going on and stroke formation and tournament results, I think that there needs to be enough separation that you gotta appreciate their time and realize that they're doing this for a living. And maybe schedule every couple of weeks to have a, you know, 30-minute or hour meeting.
So in your role as coach, are you the one that takes the players to the tournaments and watches the matches, or do the parents do that?
I do that a lot, yes.
Sorry?
I do that a lot. I was down in Florida for the last 6 years in Parkland, which is 10 miles west of Boca Raton. And in that area, you know, 90% of the tournaments are within a 10-mile radius. So it's kind of like both are going to the tournaments usually. But now that I'm back in Indiana, most of the tournaments are at least 3 to 4 hours away. So I go to a lot of the tournaments with the kids. And it's a lot of the coaches shy away from that nowadays because they say it's a liability situation. But the way I look at it, if you have a USPTA or USPTR, just PTR certification, you know, you have a few $1 million of liability insurance and what have you. So I think that it's very important that that the coaches take the kids to at least 60 to 75% of the tournaments, because at that point they're going to see what's going on during the stressful situations. And when I say stressful, I say that, you know, a tournament situation with the cortisol levels and the stress level is at its highest. That's when you really see how a junior reacts and plays, and that's when you see what breaks down and what does well. So I think it's very important that a coach sees 5 to 7 tournaments a year out of their juniors from start to finish.
Interesting. And do you charge extra for that piece of your service?
100%. Yeah. A lot of clubs now outsource it and they don't include it in the coach's salaries or their commission. And, you know, when I was growing up, it was usually $100 a day. My parents would pay the guy to take me and then all the expenses on top of that. And a lot of people still charge that, and a lot of people charge upwards of, you know, $150 to $200 a day. But I think it's enough. I think somewhere between $100 and $200 a day with expenses covers that. And I know that a lot of parents are very busy and have other kids and things like that. So I think it's nice to have. And also, looking back on my playing and my tennis life, my most favorite thing over the last, you know, call it, I'm 37, call it last 30 years that I've been traveling full-time playing, is traveling around, seeing the country, meeting people from other areas. I'm still lifelong friends with a lot of kids I grew up playing juniors with. So I think when a lot of the fun you're talking about, where's the fun at? The most fun I had playing tennis my whole life is traveling the country and traveling the world and meeting people and being able to hit tennis balls in any part of the world and the relationships that you have throughout your life from tennis. I think that's very, very much fun.
Sure, sure. And I have that on a much lower level than you, but yeah, I'm still friends with kids that I played in the juniors too. It's pretty awesome.
But also, okay. like you and I and everybody else on Facebook and bouncing our ideas off each other, you know, we're very passionate about the same thing, so it's very cool to interact with people about something everyone's passionate about.
Absolutely. One of the things that kind of got discussed during that whole Facebook exchange was that you feel like the parents are entrusting you as the coach with the job of taking their kids all the way through tennis development to a college scholarship. And
100%.
I'm sorry?
100%.
Okay. So if that's the goal, that I then asked you, so what's your formula? I mean, because college scholarships are tough to come by, especially for the boys these days. And, you know, it's a tough kind of sell. I think parents may be skeptical to hear a coach say, I'm going to get your kid a college scholarship. So can you talk a little bit about what your strategy is? I'm not asking you to give away any trade secrets, but maybe, you know, some of the things that you do or relationships that you've built that help the kids achieve that goal.
Okay. First and foremost, I think that any parent that is going to be spending the kind of money that tennis costs, that their kid, after, call it 10 to 12 years of paying that and practicing at that level, should at least have the opportunity to play college if they so desire. So let's start with that premise. And then secondly, I would say that, you know, working with both Nick Saviano and Kenneth Collins, two of the better coaches probably in the world, and very approachable guys and very much guys that are well-rounded outside of tennis. A lot of it, working with both of those guys, a lot of it has to do with the same rituals each and every day for a lot of years. And whereas that might be looked at as boring or kids have a little bit less attention nowadays with all the electronic devices and what have you, we got to quit blaming society and step up to our side of the agreement and keep on bettering ourselves as coaches and do what we can to get their ground strokes, their volleys, their transition game, and their serves to the point that they are pretty much solid by the age of 13 years old, so that at that point, from there forward, we can focus on getting stronger, faster, and playing more tournaments and more matches and working on the diet and things like that. Because the problem is that if you pick the wrong pros and you don't have the right development from, call it 4 to 6, wherever you start, to 13, and coaches are still working on your techniques and fixing serves and fixing forehand at the age of 13 to 14, you have a tough time growing and scaling up from 14 to 17 before college. So going back, a lot of my discussion today is going back to how important it is from whether you start at 4, 5, 6, or 7, those first four years of development, and how important it is to pick the right teaching professional for those ages and to monitor it and have the right grips. And I know a lot of people want to watch TV and see certain things on TV with Serena Williams and Rafael Nadal and these people. But parents have to realize that, you know, junior basketball coaches aren't telling kids to do things like LeBron James. You know, he can jump certain ways, and he can, you know, move certain ways, and he played differently at 13 than he does at 28. So I think that it's better if you ever want to, you know, have your kids emulate somebody or people, take them to college tennis matches. Take them to the top high school tennis matches. Have them watch, you know, maybe even people like Roger Federer or some people that play a little cleaner games and a little bit more traditional games, because the one thing is this: the more extreme the grips are, the more time you're going to have to practice to become a great player, and the more extreme the grips are, the more chance there is for injury. So that being said, both working with Nick Saviano and Kenneth Collins, they work with a lot of dead ball drills for the first 75% of group every day. And it was, you know, especially Nick Saviano does it, you know, 75% dead ball. When I say dead ball, I mean drop feeding out of the hands on the same side, or feeding from the basket from the opposite side, and not hitting back and forth, just hitting, getting repetitions, getting muscle memory, going back behind the cone, going back, hitting again. Nick likes to do the windshield wiper drill where you move out and you move in, you move out, you move in, you split step every time when you move out, and then you go and you transfer and you move forward, you go back and you split step. Also, he does a lot of deep ball and a short ball drill so the kids can work on their forward and backward movement. And then we always, both Kenneth Collins and Nick Saviano, always spend at least 15 or 20 minutes of the 2 hours on hitting serves and targets. I think that a lot of coaches out there don't know how to teach the serve, or how they overcook it and make it the process too strenuous. I think that the serve is a throwing motion, and that whether it's working on traps against the back curtain, or working on throwing the football, or working on, we have a thing we work on with a dog, it's like a dog thrower that throws a ball, we call the super server, throwing things in general, hitting balls over the fence. I think the serve needs to really be worked on, and the word pronation should never be used before the age of 14 or 15. The word open stance shouldn't be used before 10 or 11 years old. I think that you got to learn to hit with a, you know, an Eastern grip and hit flat before you ever learn how to hit topspin. And the sooner the kids learn to volley, the better, because, you know, you can't play indoor tennis in this country when 90% of the colleges play indoor tennis. You can't play indoor tennis without a transition game. So the earlier the kid learns how to hit twice approach shots and hit flat approach shots and learns how to switch the grip, hit volleys, and where the volleys go is very, very important. We spent a lot of time down in Florida at Terramar Park watching Alan Fox videos. We have to go to thrift shops to get the old ones. Watch a lot of Jack Grapple videos, a lot of Vic Braden videos. I think the most important video in the history of tennis to me and to our kids is Alan Fox's video about the geometry of the court and where balls go. I mean, you serve to people's backhands, you hit cross-court balls deep, cross-court, you hit, you know, first volleys that are deep down the line up the middle, you hit second volleys.
Oh, Shane, you there?
Hello? Yeah, I'm sorry. Another call was trying to come in. But I just think that basically you have to treat the kid like they are 2 to 3 years older than they are, and they're going to have to play the tennis 2 to 3 inches shorter than they are. So you got to get them getting low early at all times, and treating themselves like they're 2 or 3 years older at all times. And to be honest with you, I think that most kids have the potential to play college tennis. I just think that somewhere in the whole process, they've had the wrong pros or switched pros too many times, or got the wrong message, or didn't have the right game plan. On the women's side, 20% of golf and tennis scholarships go unused. So any girl that can get in the top 70 or 80 of their region, called 100 in their region, can play for at least a 75% scholarship. And on the men's side, you know, a lot of times people don't get scholarships to go to play at certain schools because they want to go to a big state school or what have you. There's a lot of schools out there on the Division II, on the NIAIA, different smaller conferences that offer scholarships and have three and four and four and a half scholarships. So I think that you have to be more open-minded with where you go. And nowadays, a lot of people hire a college agent, and you pay them $1,000 or $2,000, and they place you at a school. So I think that not everybody's made for Michigan or Wisconsin or UCLA or Indiana. I think that, you know, you might go to a smaller school, and if you do well there, transfer. And I think a lot of smaller schools have just a good education nowadays as the bigger ones. So you got to be more open-minded as where you're going to play at. That's a major part of the scholarship process on the boys' side.
So when you say that every kid can play college tennis, obviously you're speaking about.
No. That's assuming a lot of hours of training.
Right. But I'm saying
over the course of 8 or 10 years.
Right. But not every kid comes to tennis with either the passion for the sport, the intrinsic motivation to work hard to achieve that level, or they don't want to play college sports. I mean, that's just not in their game plan. So do you choose not to work with kids who aren't on that pathway, or, I mean, how do you differentiate? And
100%. I work with a lot of younger kids in a big group setting, you know, once a week that are 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't know where they want to go. Nobody knows. They don't have their brain's not fully developed, and their thoughts on life aren't fully developed. And I grew up with a lot of kids that didn't love it, and at 14 and 15 had success and went on to become All-Americans. I mean, who's to say when we're going to like it and love it and get after it? And who's to say, you know, Andre Agassi said he hated it, or Ali said he hated training, but would he change everything that he got and all the access he has and all the ways that he's given back, Andre, because of, you know, what tennis has given him? I mean, I think it's tough to – I think everybody's trying to overthink it by, you know, oh, my 6-year-old or my 7-year-old doesn't like this or likes this or doesn't like that or likes this. Or, you know, when I was growing up, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but kids had to go to etiquette school. They had to take piano lessons. They had to take violin lessons. They had to, you know, do things that weren't always fun but helped them, you know, later on in their lives. So, you know, I think that a lot of the best coaches in sports over the last 100 years, whether they're Bobby Knights or Nick Bollettieri's or Vince Lombardi's, or a lot of these people have military backgrounds. And, you know, we don't mess around with how we train our military, but we want to say that, you know, oh, we got to have fun and we got to be nice and they got to enjoy it every second when we train an athlete. And I think that that's the biggest thing that's changed over the last 20 years in coaching, is that the tough love's kind of out the window, and you got to be careful with what you say and how you say it, and I get that. But at the same time, if you're too soft and the kid's too soft, you're not going to build a champion, you know, in any endeavor. So a lot of times parents come to us and say, oh, my kid has this homework or that homework, or they got to take a couple weeks off because they got to focus on school. And we always say to them that, you know, whether the person's Bill Bradley or Condoleezza Rice or Steve Largent or the guy that the quarterback from the Cowboys that owns a multi-billion-dollar real estate company, all these people, you know, found a way to balance education and sports and their religion and their family and their friends and everything else. I mean, the earlier you learn to balance and to get good at managing your time, the better it's going to help you from high school, college, and in your career. So tennis is a microcosm of life. And I think that a lot of the things you're going to learn in tennis, working with others and figuring out how to change strategies in the middle of a match and you know, how to train and how to balance your tournament schedule with still seeing friends. I think all those life lessons are so important that being exposed to the game, even if you opted out 4 to 5, 6 years in and took it back a notch and didn't want to go to college, you know, or play college tennis, I think that training at those levels during a few years will still give you enough upside that it's well worth it.
What about the prevalence of overuse injuries we're starting to see now in younger and younger kids? What's the responsibility of the junior coach in that aspect of things?
Say it again.
The prevalence of overuse injuries that we're seeing in the kids that are, we're seeing adult injuries in younger and younger kids now due to overtraining, overuse.
It has a lot to do with teaching the open stance at an early age, teaching pronation too early, the polyester strings. A lot of the companies are pushing that. There's a combination of things that are leading toward that, and I can hit on a lot of them if you want me to, or I cannot, but I have a pretty strong feelings of why that's going on, and a lot of it's documented.
Well, I mean, my question is, what's the role of the coach in terms of preventing these types of injuries or managing them once they begin to crop up?
The coaches are ultimately responsible for the majority of it. I think that once we take a kid on and want to coach and work on their development, then we are responsible for, you know, at least giving them guidance on what rackets to use, what strings to use, what tension to use. Then also we're teaching them the grips to use, and we're getting to know their bodies and what deficiencies or strengths they have in their bodies, and then what to do when there's soreness as far as, you know, taking time off versus icing versus, you know, when to play and when not to play. So I think that going back to like what I said before, the top coaches and the ones that really invest in themselves and invest on getting better every single day, most of them have knowledge and certifications and have studied and you know, like Taviano and Collins are both kinesiology guys. So I think that, you know, there's such a wide range of coaches between the top and the bottom that, like I said before, it's really, really important to be working with somebody that's a top coach that will take your kid on and that will manage the whole process. And also when they get to be 14 and 15 and 16, you know, that coach has to be working hand in hand with a physical trainer, somebody that's in the gym with them. And that's definitely part of the team, and most coaches have good access to that and are overseeing that as well. So I think that the coaches are totally responsible for injuries, for you know, who to send them to try to remediate injuries, and also what kind of stuff is better to have them have less chance of getting injured.
I wonder what percentage of junior coaches have real knowledge about equipment, strains, tension, all of that. I mean, in my experience, I haven't come across very many.
Where do you live?
In Atlanta.
I think that most coaches that have played at a decently high level or that still continue to play have a pretty good gauge on equipment and strings. I think the problem sometimes with coaches is the ones that are not playing as much or hitting as much, they're not really trying out and feeling the rackets and seeing what they're like in matches and things like that. So I think it's very important that the coaches are trying the different rackets and trying the different strings and trying the kind of rackets and string combinations our players are using. I do that all the time. I always switch strings and try the rackets they're using. And you know, I pick up old junior rackets from thrift shops to I mean, it's just there's the difference in weight between a junior tennis racket from the 80s versus now is huge. I mean, the old Prince Juniors, you know, weighed a couple ounces heavier than these small Babolat rackets. So I think that as a tennis pro, if you want to justify, you know, charging a decent amount per hour and charging a decent amount to take kids to tournaments, you have to be held responsible for results, for the kid getting better, and for the injury management, and for all these things. I think that you know, whereas a high performance junior coach differs from a teaching club pro is a major, major, major difference. It would be like comparing apples to oranges. And if you want your kid to have a chance to play at the collegiate level or have a chance to go beyond that, you're going to have to find a master professional. And there are a lot of them out there, but you have to search them, and they're busy, and they're going to want to know that you guys are going to be dedicated. But there's a lot of them out there. And the issue nowadays is that a lot of the teaching pros have become salesmen and marketers and what have you, and they don't really have a track record or a lot of success or accolades. But they become popular with kids going there. And I think that the parent, like we went back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, the biggest role for the parent would be the investing their time and energy, you know, before they select coaches and then selecting or changing coaches. I mean, that is probably the biggest onus on the parent, would be selecting the man or woman that is going to be around their kid and shaping and helping mold their kid over the course of anywhere between 4 to 8 to 14 years of their life. It's very, very important. Checking the backgrounds of them, checking their resumes, checking what kind of person they are, interviewing them, all those things prior to ever hiring them is probably the biggest thing a parent needs to be doing.
In your opinion, what should the balance be between instructional time and just getting out and playing matches?
It depends on the ages. I think when they're between the ages of, call it 4 to 6 to 10 or 11, you're going to have more instructional than playing matches. And, you know, that. So at that point, you're probably 80-20 instructional versus matches. As the kid gets to be 13, 14, 15 years old, the match play is going to be more and more important. So I think that at that point, you're probably more of 60 of the instruction and 40 of the match play.
Okay.
But the majority of the, like, the way Nick Saviano does it, his academy, with their kids, they're between 6 and about 13-ish. They're about, it's about 75-25 on the instructional versus match play. And then his top kids between 14 and 18 are probably about 50-50. And it's a lot more live ball and match play because their technique is down by then, and they're playing tournaments every week.
Right, right. What is your opinion on the red, orange, green initiative with the youngest kids?
I think it is great for the masters. That being said, I think that for a kid that wants to go to college and go above college, I think that by the time they're 7 years old, if they're not playing with a regular ball, they're going to be behind the eight ball, and they're going to be behind the development curve. And, you know, a lot of seven-year-olds at that point are playing 10-under, 12-under tournaments because that's the only place they can play now. I think it's amazing for beginners the first couple of years. It's had different names over the last 30 years, but most of the top junior coaches have all used softer balls and hula hoops and different and three balls and a sock and different things like that over the last 30 years. It's always had different names and smaller nets. So this is nothing new. It's just an initiative to get more people involved in the sport. We do it on Friday, the Tri-State Athletic Club. We have the court broken up with our 3-4 and some 5-year-olds on one half with two nets. We have our 6-7-8-9-year-olds on the next court, a couple of nets. Then we have our 9-10-11s, you know, are split up on the next couple of courts using bigger courts. I mean, I think it's a great way to get people into the sport and to work on the hand-eye coordination and to learn to be around people and what have you. I think that it needs to be around for a year, year and a half, 2 years of development, and then the sooner you get out of it, the better. And some kids are going to get out of it a lot quicker than others, the ones that are more talented. I mean, the longer you stay with the wrong sizes and the wrong balls, the harder the transition will be to when they use real ball. That being said, I do love the green dot, and I think the green dot balls and the regular size court is a great tool for practice, for play, and I think it's good to have a ball that has less pressure because there'll be a lot more balls in play and the kids will have to move a lot more. So I like the green dot for the 8-9-year-olds. I just think they have to kind of get some mix in between the green dot and the real ball. A lot of times we practice with the real balls, and then we play matches with the green dot at the end of practice a couple of days before tournaments because their tournaments are green dots.
Right, right. So do you have a lot of your younger kids playing up in the 12s so that they can play with the yellow ball, or what are you doing with them?
I mean, nowadays there's different prerequisites to getting in these tournaments, so sometimes you have to play three of the green dots before you can play in the regulars and things like that. So everybody has to go through the prerequisites with the different different districts. But I mean, as soon as a kid, you know, shows that they can play at a level that's a little bit higher, we don't like to hold them back. That being said, the one exception is that we don't throw young kids up against kids that serve at a high level because, or they hit at a very high level on speed because we're trying to combat the injuries to younger kids. So, I mean, 7 and 12 is a little bit far of a reach, but, you know, a lot of kids should be playing 12s, 8, 9, 10, 11, for at least 3 or 4 years because, even when I was younger in the early 80s, they got rid of all the 10s for 5 or 6 years at the sectional level. So So we had to play. We ended up being the 12s for 4 or 5 years. So it's been going on for a long time. And when I grew up with Justin Gimelstob and the Bryan brothers and Jan Michael Gamble and Michael Russell. Those are all those guys around my age. You know, I saw, you know, Jan Michael Gamble played up a couple of years and made the move to do that. I think that if on the guy side, if you can get a kid that's dominating their age group, then you should get them up as soon as possible. I don't like it when, you know, parents or coaches move kids up just to move them up to try to not have to compete with their compatriots or their you know, people that are their same ages because there's too much pressure. I think a lot of times that's kind of like a way out. I think if you can dominate your age group, then you should definitely be playing up, you know, at least, you know, half the time. But a lot of times, especially on the girls' side now, I see a lot of the girls playing up that are not dominating their age group, and they're just doing it so they don't have to face, you know, friends and family and other kids their age and people in the city. So I think it's definitely something that has to be monitored by the coach, and the parents should definitely listen to the coaches on that, because a lot of times the parents let their egos get in the way. And a lot of times, you know, I think with the parents, a lot of it has to do, I call it cocktail talk, of, you know, my kid trains with, you know, so-and-so, and my kid trains over here, and my kid played this tournament, my kid number one in the 12s or the 10s. I think a lot of times the parents get more of an ego rush and what have you out of it than the kids do, so they keep the kids playing at a young age group just so they can dominate, or they have them in a certain academy just because of a name. And I think at the end of the day, it's all about the kids, and a lot of coaches really, really care about the kids, and have to constantly, you know, go at it with the parents. And at the end of the day, the only person that's going to suffer out of the process is going to be the kid's development. So I think the healthier relationship between the coaches and the parents, the better. And the more homework and research and investigating the parents do before they hire a coach, the better.
That's great advice. It is great advice. So we're down to our last couple minutes. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you want to touch on? Would you like to talk with us about Soulfire for a couple minutes and tell us how that came about?
I started the company, and I was a co-founder of the company in 07, but currently there's another owner in place, and we're in the middle of some litigation, so I'm not unable to speak on that.
Okay.
But just in closing, we're talking about what's fun, what's not, what's a parent's role, what's a coach's role. I think that, you know, if the parents and the coaches and the kids can get on the same page as early as possible, and if the coach can kind of draw out to the parents and the kids what their coaching philosophy is, what the game plan is, what the broad strokes of the next few years will look like, and how often we're going to, you know, sit back and talk and check the results and things like that. I think it has a lot to do with communication, and I think that as long as the coaches understand what the parents want, the parents understand what the coaches want, and the players understand what the coaches want and what have you, I think it can all work out well, and you can stay with the same coach for 6 to 8 to 10 years, you know. And I give a lot of credit to Mike Wolf with what he did with Jack Sock. And, you know, there's certain coaches out there that have worked with kids from 4 to 17 or 18, and a lot of times parents think that, oh, this guy's just good for the young kids, or this guy's just good for the older kids. A really good tennis coach that has, you know, played at a high level and coached at a high level and coached can pretty much coach your kid from 4 till college and even after college. I mean, once in a while they're going to bring other guys on to help, and they're going to have physical fitness guys to help, and you're going to set up matches on the side. But to think that you have to go train at some place because there's better kids playing there, it's probably the biggest misconception of the development of tennis. You know, if that were the case, you know, Tiger Woods, LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Roger Federer, Serena Williams wouldn't be able to get better because there's nobody better than them. So for a parent to say my kid has to go somewhere else because there's better players is totally the wrong answer. And, you know, you can set up practice matches 3 or 4 nights a week for your kids. Coaches will help you do it with adults. Dead ball drills are going to be at least 30-40% of the time. You can always get better hitting with the coaches and the hitters and the players. And there's been plenty of champions, Jimmy Connors and the Whitlingers and people that did it out of barns and gyms and not on tennis courts. So to think that you have to be around better players to get better is the biggest misconception of player development. Focus on your own development, and if you play enough tournaments and practice matches, the rest will take care of itself.
Great. Thanks so much, Shane, for being with us. We are out of time. Thank you to my listeners for tuning in. The podcast will be online at parentingaces.com on the radio show page later this afternoon. And I hope you all have a very, very happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy your time with your family and loved ones. Eat well, but don't eat too terribly much. And I'll see you next week on Parenting Aces.